The views and opinions expressed by hosts, invited speakers, and callers do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the Black Talk Media Project or the Black Talk Radio Network.
Revolution comes with a price tag. You a slave to a flag in a country that clearly doesn't love you when they probably never have. Told you turn the other cheek and they made it with a bat. Fucking protesting them citizens. Told you go fight in the war. Vietnam, you died, good riddance. The man of the house rule took you from your siblings. Turned around and pump crack right up when you did it. And they turned all your leaders to martyrs. You was off in the war, now who was guarding your daughters? It was riots in the streets, killed Malcolm and Martin. Called the National Guard up because we ride with our guard up. And that was blood in your guard. The Second Amendment don't apply to you. Everything that they taught you was a lie to you. See, they scared of your skin and they dying to shoot. Take the American dream and then you die to pursue.
One day it'll all make sense. If it ain't about power, then it don't make sense. But none of that money matters when you live in madness. So one day you figure out that all you got is this. Peace, love, and the middle finger. Right on. Peace, love, and the middle finger. Right on. Peace, love, and the middle finger. Right on. Peace, love, and the middle finger.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Black Talk Radio News. My name is Scotty Reed. I'm in for this broadcast from behind the enemy lines of USA Inc. Today's date is March 11th, 2016. It is a Friday afternoon broadcasting from a hot day here in North Carolina. And man, I heard earlier today that it was supposed to get up as high as 75 degrees, and that's just not like North Carolina weather in March, this early in March. So, wow. Again, like I stated yesterday, is this a sign of climate change? I can't say for certain, but something doesn't seem to be right. Anyway, today we do have a guest scheduled to join us. We will be speaking with the executive director of the Coalition of Schools Educating Boys of Color, Mr. Ron Walker. He'll be joining us here in just about 3 minutes or so. Let me make sure that we have the studio line open. Yes, it is open. By the way, if you have any questions, any comments during our interview or later on in the broadcast as we hit some of these news stories, let me give out those phone numbers. The conference line, 641-715-3660, 641-715-3660. The participant code is 549032#, and you hit *6 and 1 to signal the host, and we'll bring you right in. You could also use that web-based flash phone to make a call from anywhere in the world, and the studio line is 704-951-5030. That's 704-951-5030, and the studio lines are open. Before I talk a little bit more about what we'll be speaking to our guest about and some of the news stories that I'd like to share with you today, let me just go ahead and the listener that called into the program from the Virgin Islands, I apparently didn't write down your telephone number, so if you could give us a call back or have the radio station in the Virgin Islands resend that email, because I have not been able to find that email. Please do that. Apparently I got the wrong number because I haven't been able to connect with you via that way. All right, so once we get through with our interview with Mr. Ron Walker, some of the things in the news that we will discuss. You got black feminist Bell Hooks coming out and saying she can no longer support Hillary Clinton. We'll play that clip for you. Feminist activist Berta Caceres, who was assassinated last week in Honduras, singled out Hillary Clinton for backing the 2009 Honduran coup that led to the removal of the democratically elected Honduran president. I don't recall his name, and we went over some of that yesterday. I want to revisit that today. Also, you may have heard, maybe not, Ben Carson is endorsing Donald Trump. And that shocks a lot of people because, you know, last time I checked, you know, Ben Carson was a black man. And so how do you reconcile the racism, the white terrorism that we're seeing going on at these rallies with black people being attacked? How do you reconcile that? And then this man actually inciting violence at these places. So, you know, that's crazy. But then in another case of proxy racism, we got Omarosa. Remember, she was on, I guess, what was that, The Apprentice show? Well, she says that Trump protesters are getting what's coming to them at these rallies. So those are some of the news stories that we will be discussing. First, we do want to talk about the upcoming event that the Coalition of Schools Educating Boys of Color will have. That's going on from May 18th to the 21st. It will be the 10th annual gathering of leaders, and it will bring together organization members from across the country, more than 200 youth participants, guest speakers, workshop presenters, and charitable supporters at the New York City's Jacob Javits Convention Center. And they have a number of confirmed speakers, but I do believe we have the executive director, Mr. Ron Walker, on the line. Do we have you on the line, sir?
Yes, sir, you do.
All right. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for the invitation.
Oh, you're certainly welcome. Let me just check the audio because you seem to be coming in a little bit low, sir. Can you give me a mic check?
Okay, I'm calling from a remote phone. Can you hear me now?
Yes, that's better. That's better. We got you. We got you. Thank you again for joining us today on Black Talk Radio Network. As we get started, can you just give the listeners, you know, as much as you like to share, your personal bio and what led you into this work and helping to educate our black boys?
I certainly will, Brother Reed, and thank you again for the invitation. First of all, my narrative begins in Philadelphia. I'm a native of Philly, though I'm living in Boston now. I was born and raised toward school with Sayre Junior High School in Philly and went through schooling to the high school and then went on to Lincoln University to get my bachelor's degree in the late 60s when I graduated in 1968. I happened to be in Lincoln at the same time. I was a classmate of Gil Scott Heron and John and Erica Huggins. And, you know, Lincoln was that kind of the hotbed of activism during the late 60s. I spent some time in Mississippi in a place called Belzoni, Mississippi in 1966. Little did I know at the time, it was also called Bloody Belzoni just because of the level of racist activism that was taking place there. But fast forwarding, you know, when I graduated from Lincoln, I went to Temple and got my master's degree in urban education and then taught school for the next 7 years, 8 years, I'm sorry, at Sayre Junior High School, which is located at 58th and Walnut Street. From there, I got a fellowship to come to Massachusetts. A fellowship was called the National Urban Fellows. And it was allowed me to get my master's degree again and allowed me to really learn and take a deeper dive into the urban issues that affect the country and affect our people in particular. I went on to become a principal in Massachusetts, and I was a principal for 10 years. And then I went on to worked in the field of national school transformation. But the reason why I started, and kind of the tipping point for me to start the Coalition of Schools Educating Boys of Color, comes from a former student of mine, a seventh grade student by the name of Kevin Johnson. And he was one of those young men who many who are in teaching can remember. He was bright, personable, really had a lot going for him, a lot of assets going for him. This brother, you know, really could have been all he wanted to be. So when I left Philadelphia, to come to Massachusetts, we parted company, and I kind of counseled and mentored him and said, Kevin, you know, remember, just to really do what you need to do so you can soar to the great heights. And so, typical to a 14-year-old young man, he said, Mr. Walker, I'll be okay. Don't worry about me. I got this. So let me go forward in time. That was 1978 when I left Philly. I received a letter in 1986 that was earmarked from the penitentiary, Frackville State Penitentiary, upstate Pennsylvania. Mm. And when I opened it up, you know, it read the following way. Mr. Walker, you won't believe who, where I am. Hope you remember me. This is your former student, ninth grade student, Kevin Johnson. I'm incarcerated for a crime I did not commit. It's for murder of a drug dealer. And I'm here sentenced with life without parole. So, you know, that kind of, first of all, surprised me. But Kevin and I started a writing campaign from 1986 to the present day. And in 2006, I got an invitation by way of a phone call from the principal of the Frackville State Penitentiary School. Little did I know that Kevin had been serving as an inmate assistant, had been working in the school, had got his GED, and he had been petitioning the principal to give me a call to see whether I would come up to Frackville State to deliver the commencement or the keynote message to the 100 men who were getting their GED and college credit. So in 2006, September, I flew to Philly from Boston, drove to Frackville State Penitentiary, and this was the first time I laid physical eyes on Kevin Johnson mm-hmm. in over 30 years. So that was an emotional time together. We broke some bread together. And then I was about to make ready to deliver the keynote message, but I followed an inmate who was the valedictorian. And he said to the group, family, his fellow classmates, he said, I may not ever see freedom, but I'm free because I'm now educated. Well, for me, that was my tipping point. Now, I was at a time in my career where I had done a lot of things in principle and I could have easily made ready for retirement. Mm-hmm. And I decided on that day that I was going to start this organization, Coalition of Schools Educating Boys of Color, because what we know, and I know what your listeners know, is that the narrative, you know, though it may be typically dismal, we know better. We know that our young men and men have promise, many assets, and if they are encouraged, mentored, coached, and taught well, they can do well. So my intention was to develop an organization whose mission it was to change the narrative. And I knew I had to do that by working with school leaders and school educators. That was the field I knew, to really get them to understand what they could do to provide the development and education necessary for boys and women of color. So here we are, 10 years later, still standing. I mean, we've gone through ups and downs, as you know, most nonprofits do, but we're still standing. And we've worked with well over thousands of young men across the country who work in school districts across the country. And so we'll be convening in New York City, the Big Apple, to give our 10th anniversary gathering of leaders that we're so excited about.
That name Kevin Johnson is familiar to me. And it sounds like a case that I have covered with an attorney.
I'm sure you have, because it's been in the news.
Rachel Wankenstein, has she worked on his case? I believe I've heard this story about he was in a bar or something with some friends and somebody was killed and he got framed up for it. That name sounds very, very familiar. And we're not talking about Kevin Rasheed Johnson, are we?
No, I don't believe his middle name is Rasheed.
Okay.
That I don't know, but it was similar circumstances. He was, you know, in the Woodland Avenue area. I think he was selling some clothes out of his car. Long story short, it was a crack dealer who was murdered. Now, most recently, over this past year, the person who framed him came forward, and Kevin's attorney sent me the deposition saying that she framed him because she knew where the crack dealer's crack was, and she was a crack addict, and she needed to get that crack. And so Kevin became, you know, the person who was framed as the perpetrator. But she had since recanted that that story.
Yeah, that's the same case. That's a familiar case to us, because we frequently focus on wrongful convictions on various programs on this network. All right. So I just want to commend you, though, because like you stated, you could have just retired and, you know, been playing golf or whatever it is you like to do for recreational activities and, you know, enjoy, you know, the rest of your life. But you didn't do that. So, you know, you got a heart for the people, particularly these young people. And so I just want to thank you, sir, you know, for, you know, coming out of retiring or not retiring and starting this coalition of schools educating boys of color. So thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Now, can you tell the people the primary mission of the Coalition of Schools Educating Boys of Color? And I imagine this is the 10th annual gathering that you all will have. Is that how old the organization is, 10 years or a little older?
That's correct. The organization is 10 years old, so this is our 10-year anniversary. And to be specific, the mission of the Coalition of Schools Educating Boys of Color is to connect, to inspire, to support, and to strengthen school leaders who are dedicated to the social, emotional, and academic development of boys and young men of color. Now, why do I say that? Now, as I said, I'm a former principal, and I know many principals, and certainly I know a lot of teachers, and oftentimes because they are either overwhelmed with kind of the things that get in the way of really making connections and engaging young men and young ladies, that the day, the month, the week, the year gets by them. Mm-hmm. But what we're trying to do is to really support their energy to say, hey, we have a crisis in the country. The village is on fire. And for those of us who know what schooling can be, that can really be the lifeline for success for boys and young ladies, they need to make sure that they have teachers in front of them who understand them, who know how to teach them, know how to reach them. They need to know that the principal in that office, he or she, is working in their best interest, mm-hmm. working to support their parents. So that's our mission. Our primary niche are those principals. But having said that, you know, we also at our convenings have teacher leaders, have parent leaders, community members, academics. So it really becomes a whole village model, but our primary focus was initially on the principal.
Now, when you all gather and or you on your daily communications as you work with these different people involved in education, does the subject of school to prison pipeline ever come up? And what role do you think, you know, teachers and other educators can play in preventing our young people, you know, from entering into that pipeline?
Right. Well, you know, it comes up. It comes up quite frequently. Because, you know, of the data, you know, and the data across the national data, which looks at graduation and suspension rates, you know, when you really pick all that apart, it's often too often that boys of color, black and Latino boys, are the ones who are most likely to be in the ditch, to be in the gap. You know, so if you're 5 years old and you start school off, and by the way, you know, I would ask you to listen to this question, though I can't get the answer for you by way of the phone. But if I asked the question, what student group was the student group most expelled the most often from school? Mm-hmm. Well, most people might say, well, the middle school, because, you know, middle school students are, you know, wiggly and antsy. Okay. But the answer is preschool black boys.
What?
Are the number one student group documented. A Yale study by Dr. Reginald Gilliam, and other studies, black boys at preschool are expelled the most frequently. Now,
wow!
If that was that's a fact that, you know, we really should not be in any way happy about. But if you start a young man off 4 or 5 years old, and they've already been expelled from preschool, and you start them off. And so if your listeners know that a sound preschool education is where you learn to read and, you know, determine right. colors and you start your handwriting and mm-hmm. all that and your verbal fluency. So if you're denied that, and you're coming into the kindergarten, into the formal setting, my experience tells me oftentimes, too often, you know, your background follows you. You know, right. Somehow people know that little Ronnie, you know, had was kicked out of preschool. So we better watch out for him. Okay? So if you don't have that kind of teacher who understands child development,
right,
who understands how to engage and reach out and look at the assets in little Ronnie, not the deficits, then little Ronnie could very easily by and before third grade be on a downward slide. Now what happens? Well, what happens if they can't read at grade level, mm-hmm, then very often what you do, you act out and your behavior gets affected. So when your behavior becomes an issue in schools that are underprepared or to work with boys of color, then they get referred to special education, mm-hmm, because something's wrong with little Ronnie. He can't sit still. He can't read. His behavior is atrocious. Okay? So I had a young man tell me one time that, you know, he was in special education. He realized that once you get in special education, if you're not in the right setting, now special education by itself is not a bad thing. Some of our kids need that support.
Okay.
But too often, too many of our boys get into the behavioral aspect of special education and they're sentenced there. They see that as a sentence. So that begins the trajectory. You follow what I'm saying?
Yes, sir.
So I'm not reading up to grade level. My behavior has been signaled out. Perhaps my parents haven't been involved. I haven't had the teachers who might be prepared to really reach and teach me. So you can see the rest of the cycle is when I'm not engaged, when I'm not excited about learning, then it's easy for me to get into things that lead to that prison. Thus the pipeline. But the pipeline starts, and it starts even before preschool, you know, and this is where all of our parents need to be fully engaged from the cradle right on through, you know, on how to help our young boys and young men, you know, negotiate life and negotiate what is the school bureaucracy.
You know, Mr. Walker,
mm-hmm,
Mr. Walker, I'm trying to wrap my mind around what possibly could a kindergartner, a 5-year-old, could do to warrant suspension.
That's right. Well, and as I said,
Mr. Walker, because
it starts even before kindergarten. That expulsion is in preschool.
Preschool.
Okay. So then you're talking about 4 years old, three and a half, 4 years old,
right?
Approaching five, and oftentimes it's because they may not see a young man behaving according to the standards that are set. You know, managing himself well. You know, he maybe has a lot of energy, which boys typically do.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're not trained in child development or how to really work with little kids, and particularly little black boys, little brown boys, you know, you're pushing them out. And that starts the cycle.
I mean, but it seems to me that also, you know, at that early development, also you're supposed to be teaching them how to interact. You know, maybe a child pushes another child, you know, on the playground, or there might actually be a fight, some biting,
exactly,
or stuff like that. But, I mean, that's to be expected when these children have never really had that kind of social interaction outside of their families. You know what I'm saying? And so I just can't think of any reason other than you just don't want to deal with these children is why you would expel them.
Well, you put your finger on some of it, you know, and that's also look at the reality that we have, and I want to be very clear to say we're not putting a blanket on all pre-school educators. We're not putting a blanket on all educators because, you know, I'm an educator, have been for 45 years, and so but what we are saying is that it's even more important,
okay,
for young people who are going into teacher preparation programs or early childhood preparation programs to really be trained well. So that also goes to the institutions that they attend. If the institution doesn't really take time to talk about culturally responsive approaches to teaching little black boys, then they're missing the boat. You know, so it's a whole system and cycle that you can put your finger on. But coming into teaching, like I always have said, to my teachers and for those young people that I talk to on a regular basis about coming into teaching, the only thing more important than being a teacher is being a parent, because you're that close to the development of young people.
Right.
You know, and so if you take it, anytime I can tell you, Brother Reed, you know, after through my career, I have had now my oldest students are in their 50s, okay, because I'm 69. All right. I have emails, calls from older students said, you know, I still remember some of the things you did. That's what you want to remember from teachers, the positive things.
Right.
Okay. And so, because they make that much of an impression on our kids. And that's how important this work is. And as I said to many of my friends, it's time for us to ignite what I'm calling a conspiracy of care.
Okay.
It's time for us to really to take a look at, you know, how we're treating our young people, how we're teaching our young people, you know, and how connected we are as the village, you know, it takes the village to raise a child. It ain't just the teachers. It takes every part of the village to raise these boys and young men so they can reach success, and so that they don't have to have the outcome that happened to my former student, Kevin Johnson.
I would agree with that wholeheartedly, sir. We've had Dr. Umar Johnson on the program in the past, and he on this program in the past. He was recently on another program on our network, but they weren't talking about, you know, school and education and whatnot. But when I had invited him on the program, it was due to the release of his book, which I can't recall the title, but he talked about the over-prescribing of psychotropic drugs to our children. You kind of touched upon, you know, these children being more just shoved into special education. And I get that some of them may need that because they may have some developmental challenges. And so they may need to be there. But, you know, Dr. Umar Johnson often said some of the things that you mentioned about these boys being very active and whatnot. And then, you know, putting labeling them with ADHD, you know, too quickly and putting them on these drugs. Is that something that you all take a look at?
Yes, we do. I mean, one of the things that we're doing at the gathering of leaders, the 10th annual gathering of leaders, is we're hosting a special Saturday session called There's Trauma in the Village. Now, we know, and Brother Johnson is certainly has greater expertise than me, but there is this overprescribing. You know, when I was a principal, you know, up close and personal, I can't tell you how often the first thing that would come out of a teacher's mouth or a child or a child psychologist's mouth that we had an assessment was, you know, can we put them on Ritalin? How fast can we get them on the, you know, Ritalin or whatever the drug that is now used today?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what happens, and I've seen it very often, that a young man or young woman with the kind of energy that young kids will have and adolescents will have suddenly get zombified.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I've seen that. And, you know, that's not the state of the condition we want our kids in. Now, again, there are circumstances. I think we're all aware there's always situations that may need a different prescription. But, you know, we don't want to over-prescribe drugs. You can see now the catastrophe that's taking place with the opioid crisis around the country that's hitting the suburbs and the rural parts of this country.
Yes, sir.
You know, so we know too frequently that that has happened to our kids. And so what we're trying to look at is if that affects mental health, mental wellness, mental clarity, you know, when you really on your game because you either prescribe drugs or either you've been involved and seen or witnessed trauma, which may necessitate something. So, you know, a lot of things that's taking place in the village, we have to send out the call for healing. This is healing time now because we are, you know, we are the, like you've heard it before, Superman not coming to rescue you or me.
Right.
We got to do it. We have to do it.
I want to ask your opinion on charter schools because here in North Carolina, where we're based and where I live, and they just had a conference of home not homeschoolers, but these what's the word again? I just lost my train of thought.
Well, you do.
These
you
charter
do
schools.
Schooling and you have charter schools.
Yes. Oh, okay. But here in North Carolina, they just won a case at the state Supreme Court level that's going to allow them to expand these charter schools. And so they've been having conferences. And it is something that I have looked at over the years. We have had people on who run Afrocentric charter schools. Some of these schools here in North Carolina are primarily serving black children, and they are, you know, some success stories coming from that. Now, it's not that I'm against, you know, public education or for public education through this public system, or against or for charter schools. I'm for whatever works. You know, I'm for whatever works and whatnot. So what is your experience in that area? What are your viewpoints on these charter schools? Because we keep hearing a whole lot of pushback from the black community against charter schools. And, I kind of feel like that conversation is a little one-sided, and that we may not be considering all the, you know, information or the possible benefits.
Well, first of all, I've been a public school educator all my life, although charter schools are public schools too, but in the traditional public school, I've been, you know, in that vein. But at the same time, I've been on the board of one or two charter schools. And, since my organization is a member organization, we have members who are charter schools. For example, the Eagle Academy for Young Men, that's a public school. That's not a charter school. But in Chicago, one of our members, Urban Prep Academy, that had 5 successful years of 100% graduation rates and all the young men going to college. Charter school. Boys Latin Academy in Philadelphia. Great success story. Charter school. So I think I land in this way. Number one, similar to what you said, I want to know what works. I don't want to see public schooling undermine, a traditional public school undercut.
Right.
But I want to see what works. And in America, and I still live in America, I have a choice. And I like to think that everybody should have a choice or an option. Just like you can't tell me that I have to vote for, even though I'm registered Democrat, if I decide to change my mind, that's my choice. So I think choice is important, but understanding the strings that go with choice, which means you got to do your homework. Mm-hmm. You got to be really a student, not to just blindly follow something because it's labeled a charter school or because it's not a charter school. You know, how is it set up? How is it organized? You know, how do they certify their teachers? You know, what's the curriculum? Mm-hmm. You know, because this day and age, we know one thing for sure, that things have to change in traditional public schools so that our children, boys and young ladies, understand their story, right?
Right.
Which oftentimes is confusing or not even told at all.
Right.
Or confined to 1 month.
Right.
And that leaves us in a situation where we've been traditionally in that situation for hundreds of years, where we don't know self.
Right.
And when you don't know self, you're easily led to anything.
Right.
So I'm in favor of parents who say, you know what, I'm going to do my homework because I got one child or two children, and they're only going this one way, one time in life. I'm going to make the best research choice, not get it caught up in emotion. Not to get caught up in the political thing, but what's going to work for my son or my daughter? And so I always encourage parents to ask one fundamental question when they go into a school environment. If they meet the teacher, you know, principal first and then go to the teacher that may be educating their children. And that question is, what should my son or my daughter know, understand, and be able to do by the time they leave your classroom? Now, if the teacher says, why are you asking that question? That's time for you to pivot and get out the door. If the teacher says, great question, glad you asked, then you know you got something. Now, you can ask that question in a charter school setting or a public school setting. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, there's failing public schools, traditional, and there's failing charter schools.
Right.
But if you're not educated and you don't know what questions to ask, even that fundamental, easy question,
right,
then you can be easily led astray.
Yeah, asking questions is always important in all activities, people activities. Yeah, that's always important.
And you'd be surprised how many parents don't know even the art of asking questions. You know, you and I take it for granted, mm-hmm, right? But because you're not going to just be hoodwinked. Mm-hmm. But oftentimes that whole process, there's a program called the Right Question Project. I used to be on the board in Massachusetts, and they teach parents something called the question formulation technique, because too many of our parents are not enjoying the fruits of democracy because they don't know what questions to ask.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens? They get angry, they may rage, but they're not asking that fundamental question that I posed.
One last question on the subject of public education, and then I want to want you to give us some more details about what people can expect
mm-hmm,
if they attend the 10th annual gathering of leaders that again will occur on May 18th through the 21st. Your 10th annual gathering. But speaking of politics, this has been part of the Democratic debate, whether or not, you know, public colleges, whether we can, as a nation, can do tuition-free public colleges and universities. Now, in this conversation, I think that people playing politics have been manipulating these proposals that have been put forth by Bernie Sanders, and saying, you know, making people think, well, you know, we can't pay for everybody to go to college. Well, he's not talking about sending, you know, paying for your kid to go to Harvard, Yale, or any place like that. But then, you know, President Obama, just in September, he reconvened another working group to work on making community college, which is a public college, making community college 2 years tuition free. And so that's getting, I think, a lot of people in this current debate are not even recognizing that's something that President Obama has worked on. As an educator, do you think, specifically with black people, since we are in Latinos, since we're in disproportionately impoverished and whatnot, do you see that as something we should be pushing for? And do you think it can be done?
Indeed, I do. And I'll tell you that history, again, when you study history, this has been done before.
Yes,
sir,
it has.
I just got back from California.
Mm-hmm.
And the California state school system for colleges and university, college, state colleges, that was the model. You know, during the 80s and during that tuition for state colleges. So it's not that this hasn't been done before, but I am so much in favor of that, because you and I know, and your listening audience knows, that you cannot do anything without an advanced degree. You can't. You know, it's just not going to happen to the degree or to, you know, to the expectations of success in the long-term future. And so it is absolutely essential that particularly people who have limited means have that same opportunity to knock on the door of success by getting a college education. Community college, 4-year college, absolutely. You know, and that's the only way that we're going to really enjoy the fruits what the Constitution says, that we should all have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And the only way you can be able to get that is getting a quality education.
Can you tell us about some of the events that will be held at this 10th annual gathering?
Certainly. We open up, make this a special note. This gathering is both for the adults. We have three days for the adults. That starts on the 18th of our pre-session for principals and starts officially on the 19th, 20th, and 21st. And then we also have a 2-day session for young men. So the same time that the adults will be going through workshops, different plenaries, and conversations, the young men will be having their own sessions, rites of passage session, touring the city of New York, making college tours. They'll be meeting other young men from around the country. On the 19th of May, when we open up officially, the first official day, we have something called the Walk of Integrity. And that is a special event when 100, 125, in fact, we had our largest Walk of Integrity when we had North Carolina Central a few years back when we did our seventh annual gathering in North Carolina. And this is when young men walk down the center aisle and with precision, led by drummers, led by elders, and they have a chance to take the floor, take the stage, to share with the adults why their education is so important. So that's our traditional opening. And so after that, you know, we have workshops, we have special speakers, and, you know, we're going to have an award session. We'll have some evening events in New York, where we'll be showing some special films that showcase what schools are doing that are successful working with boys and young men of color. So it's going to be, you know, a full event for all those who attend. And I would encourage your listening audience to go to our website. That's COSBOC, C as in coalition, O as in outstanding, S as in school, E as in excellent, B as in boy, O as in outstanding, C as in courageous.org, and you can get all the information on the 10th annual gathering of leaders, and you'll also see all the things that we do over the course of the year.
For those that are listening, either through TuneIn or some of the other radio platforms that we simulcast on, I have provided a link as well that'll be on the page once it's also turned into a podcast, folks. So for those that's listening on the podcast, you know, come to Black Talk Radio Network. .com and look in the archives for Black Talk Radio News, and you'll find that link as well. What about you mentioned that you're a membership organization. What does that, you know, membership look like?
Yeah, so you can be an individual member. And on the website, it has all the structure and the breakdown. You can be an individual member, or schools become members, or school districts have become members. And, you know, they get access to special rates to come to the conference, special rates if they have some of our professional development. On the website, one of the things that we have formerly was just a members-only benefit, but we felt it was so important that everybody should have access to it. On the website, you'll see a downloadable document called Standards and Promising Practices for Schools Educating Boys of Color. And it will give you seven core areas that if you are a parent, if you are a teacher, you are a principal, you are a superintendent, and you want to take an assessment of how that school or your son is attending, is faring, and what are they doing, or some questions you want to pose, that document will assist you in a major way. So membership has its privileges. And what we're trying to do, Brother Scotty, is to grow the movement, because we know that our boys and young men of color are a precious commodity and filled with assets. And it's up to us on our watch to do all we can to help them in their success. That's what we're about.
Well, I certainly, again, want to commend you for having the foresight and the will to do this, because again, you could be off on a golf course or somewhere fishing and just enjoying your retirement. Not to say you don't enjoy your what you do, because you have to enjoy what you're doing in order for you to be engaged in it, you know. When you don't have to. Is there anything you'd like to say to the listeners in closing?
I would thank you again, Brother Scotty, for this opportunity to share with your listeners. I just want to say that we've all heard the African proverb, it takes a village to raise a child. Now more than ever, we know that the village is under assault. And so it's going to take will, energy, dedication, and devotion to re-raise the village so that everybody can play a role in saving our sons and supporting our daughters. I mean, this is a mission. This is mission-driven work. It's not a moment. This is a movement. And it's a place for everybody who has children, or even if you don't have children, if you retired, doesn't matter. You can play a role in helping this village and creating this conspiracy of care. I would like to see as many educators and concerned community people from North Carolina. What part of North Carolina are you
in Gaston County, just outside of Charlotte.
Okay, great. So in the Charlotte area and throughout the state of the great state of North Carolina, you know, those folks who want to make that trek to New York to join us, we really want to welcome you there, because, you know, all hands on, working together, we can make a difference in the lives of boys and young men. So I want to thank you very much for the time.
And thank you, Mr. Ron Walker. And we hope that you will visit with us again as it gets closer to the gathering, so that we can just remind the listeners. And then after, if you could give us a report after, you know, the event has taken place, we would love to have you back.
Well, I'd love to be back, and I also got some key people to talk about the rites of passage and what we're going to be doing. So just let me know. I'll be happy to join you again.
All right. Thank you, sir, and you have a great day.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Okay. Wow. I did not know that they were suspending kids in pre-K, in kindergarten. I really had no idea. Wow. So, wow. So again, if you want to find out more information, you can go to the website. Again, that is COSEBOC. Let me say that again. That is COSEBOC. .org. Again, there is a link for today's program description right there on the page. Now, I'm going to take a station identification break, kick some message music, and when we come back, I want to talk about some of the things in the news. Oh, by the way, if you have any thoughts on what we just heard from Mr. Walker, please call in and share them. Area code 641-715-3660. The participant code for the conference line is 549032 pound. Hit *6 and 1. You can also use the web-based flash phone as long as you have a pair of headsets to connect with us. And again, the studio line is 704-951-5030. But just hold your calls until we come back on the other side of this break. Do want to get into some of the news of the day. Black feminist bell hooks says she can no longer support Hillary Clinton. The assassinated feminist activist, non-white person in Honduras, was assassinated last week. Before she was assassinated, she singled out Hillary Clinton for backing the Honduran coup. We'll listen to a clip from Democracy Now! On that. Dr. Ben Carson has endorsed Donald Trump. That really kind of, I told my mom about that. We had a conversation about that because, you know, my mom is a practicing Christian and a very strong woman of faith. And she, you know, admired Dr. Carson. And she, you know, I had to talk to her. I mean, I talked to her about some of the controversial proxy racist things that he has said in the past, but I think the icing on the cake for her, well, it was the icing on the cake for her, was his endorsement of Donald Trump. And she said now she's viewing him, Dr. Carson, through a different lens. Then you had Omarosa. I don't remember that lady's first name. But she was on CNN. I believe it was Chris Matthews she was talking to. And they were talking about this violence that was going on at these Trump rallies. And, you know, CNN and other networks have been focusing on and asking the question, is he inciting these people to violence? Is this criminal activity? And, well, Omarosa says that, you know, these protesters are getting exactly what's coming to them. All right. So I tell you, man. And I also, before I go to the break, before I forget, we got an email about yesterday's program from one of our longtime listeners, and it was concerning the clip that I play from time to time of Neely Fuller, who says that the clip where he talks about it not being about black versus white and about justice versus non-justice. And, you know, if you're a black person and you don't believe in practicing justice, then your being black don't mean anything. What does that mean? You know, if you're white and you practice injustice, if you're a white terrorist and all that kind of stuff. But and the emailer made some valid points, saying that, you know, black people have always, you know, been the moral consciousness of, you know, this country. And we have always advocated against the mistreatment of people, even outside of our groups and whatnot. But, you know, and I don't disagree with that. But I also know that our history is not monolithic. And our people aren't monolithic. And through my studies of history here in the United States and even throughout the world, black people have assisted the system of racism and white supremacy. Okay? And so I think that is my interpretation of what Mr. Fuller was saying, is that, you know, what good is you being black? You talking about you black and all this and that, and you proud to be black, but yet, you know, you helping white people, or I should say white supremacists, racists, to harm other black people or to harm other victims, like other non-white people, you know. I think he's talking about people like Dr. Ben Carson or like a Omarosa, who's saying that these black protesters get, you know, pretty much deserve what they get. And whatnot. So, yeah, I mean, I know where you're coming from, brother. I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just saying is, let's also acknowledge that part of our history where we have aided not only this country, you know, but white supremacists in harming other people. So that, you know, for whatever reasons, you know, so I just wanted to acknowledge that. I do appreciate the emails and the feedback that we do get on any of our programs. Again, agreement isn't 100% necessary. We just have to be respectful towards each other, you know, but all points of view are welcome. So, again, I'm not disagreeing with what he's saying. I'm just saying, please consider, you know, throughout history, those individuals who have assisted the system of racism and white supremacy. And I think Mr. Fuller refers to them in his code book as the eight ballers for white supremacy, which is a term I had not heard since the 1980s. You know, we had the eight ball jackets and whatnot, or, you know, it's a variation of the word baller or whatnot, but they balling. They ball. You got black people that's balling for white supremacy in exchange for butter biscuits and other benefits. Personal benefits. Okay, so you're listening to Black Talk Radio News. Again, my name is Scotty Reed, and I am indeed broadcasting from behind the enemy lines of USA Inc. We'll be back on the other side.
I scratched up.
You're listening to the Black Talk Radio Network. Stay tuned.
When we see our people being brutalized by white bigots, white racists, we think that they are foolish to allow themselves to be beaten and brutalized and do nothing whatsoever to protect themselves. They are foolish. They should have the right to defend themselves against any attack made against them by anyone. If a dog is biting the black man should kill the dog. Whether the dog is a police dog, a hound dog, or any kind of dog. If a dog is fixed on a black man, when that black man is doing nothing but trying to take advantage of what the government says it's supposed to be is, then that black man should kill that dog or any two-legged dog. We'll be right back. I think you'll find, sir, that there will come a time when black people wake up and become intellectually independent enough to think for themselves, as other humans are intellectually independent enough to think for themselves, then the black man will think like a black man, and he will feel for other black people. And this new thinking and feeling will cause black people to stick together. And then at that point, you'll have a situation where when you attack one black man, you are attacking all black men. And this type of black thinking will cause all black people to stick together. And this type of thinking also will bring an end to the brutality inflicted upon black people by white people. And it is the only thing that will bring an end to it. No federal court, state court, or city court will bring an end to it. It's something that the black man has to bring an end to, has to bring an end to, has to bring an end to.
May appear a confusing blur of activities, each ant doing its own thing, but it can't be. Somehow the ants coordinate their actions so that large insects are overwhelmed, killed, and carried back to the base.
Pairs is dying and my people are suffering. The money's still low, you should see how they budget it.
Just watch what comes out your mouth.
People are suffering. It's elementary, they want us all gone eventually. Pairs is dying, people are suffering. The money's still low, you should see how they budgeting. Pairs is dying, and my people are suffering. The money's still low, they want us all gone eventually.
I swear to God, living in this economy is like a robbery. The government taxing me when they owe me for my property. You niggas act like you happy to live in poverty. When I feel like a king, they gotta make these fools acknowledge me. I'm royalty and loyal to the feeling of it. The contrast make it look thuggish. We talk, walk, and look rugged. Naturally, nothing sad to see. We all a part of this tragedy. I'm mad at you, so why you mad at me?
We headed for the times of the nine. Watch out, six. Sun cycle on the rise. Moon cycle out the mix. Living on this planet of the snakes and the crucifix. Pardon yourself as I unk my way through. Marching with my A-boom boom. Making my debut. Like great balls. A fire, nothing could save you in these replenishing times. I honor my dead, making my ancestors proud when it's off with your head.
Does my pencil possess potential to change mental jest? Short with your pen in this pack with the essential less. What is essential to keep it? The sharpest against you, yes. What is essential to keep it like a temple? Blast, alter the temple, keeping the beat simple and fresh. While they whimper and rest, I'm intuition like the simplest guess. Into tradition, I'm on a mission until I transition to give the up and coming a better existence with every breath.
Form, reaching for a point of two. The older we get, it switches up the point of view. And they anointed you, leader of the free world. Desolate minds refined to the B-girl. The most benevolent is evident who I be. Graffiti on the wall, the crew, Drew Ali. Zoo, who I key, shifting on the paradigm. Raise the vibration, then go prepare the mind.
Define magnificent, rare gem. Dip deep, the omnipotent, all seeing. I just speak the game plan. I pray for niggas, amen. That sharp is great. Can I made man for sway fans, no street skating, no beat taking. For Pete's sake, he's the beast quaking, the scene shaking. No mistaking, the ants conquer the elephants. FTPRBG, the rest of the fella.
What's the ant's secret that makes them the most efficient predators on Earth? Consuming more meat than lions, tigers, and wolves combined.
I'm way medicated, puff lying, lay sedated. In spades dedicated to culture that created the essence of the lessons now delivered in my presence. Kalonji called upon me, so now I pose the question. How is it that the black came in whips and chains, having nothing else to lose and everything to gain? Now niggas entertained for some whips and chains, a white dame in some pain. That shit not strange, kinda hard holding down your dreams when you're black and in America with institutions set to bury you 6 feet underneath dirt for debt deep. Disciples psychological when making those ends meet and needs be. A hand feeds the other teasers. Gather thoughts, grab the gatling for good reason. In between success, devil's greed, a pine box of mind jobs and losers.
And why I come off and camouflage, can't take claws. Eating lentils and vegetable broth, but I ain't never been soft. Beating the loss of forsaken by any cost. Bones aching, working hard, trying to bring home the turkey bacon. Breaking laws of gravity, fuck with the family and watch me savagely. Crush craniums and chest cavities to pray for the casualties. My anatomy is naturally casually composed. This is so of construction for the soul.
I'm black dynamite, I'll blast you with my nitro. Spit a dope piece with a gold piece and a booth with five disciples. We channeling boot mind, the revolution sparker. With an 8-bar cigar smoking some dark rum on the altar. Watch the doctor work a mojo, walk the stage without a hype man. Electric verses turn a great crowd into light rain. Plus psyches for the LBs, the brain food that's got hot fly wisdom. Called Saucy, the enlightener, that's Cyra.
2012 and times are different yet the same. Nowadays the number of prisoners behind the cage outnumber amounts of those enslaved during the trades and shame. We're killing ourselves over what's that you blame. Getting shot instead of hang. Nothing changed for the better except the chatter of corporate property gain. The more money in pocket, the more people in chain. Night niggas who bang, destroy their main aim.
It's all connected, form a web like a Nazi. It's the people, Yahoo is the army. Start a top contender, where you plot the new agenda. They even reborn a track, sucker and food for dinner. All that garbage I'm pinning, it's right, cheers the ending. Words of venom, getting them wrapped in Egyptian linen. Coming for head, this rapper, Kali will shake the rapper. Only in dead and after, walking natural disaster. Rapture.
Make Black Talk Radio your choice for digital black radio, new black media for the new millennium. And welcome back to Black Talk Radio News. Scotty Reed in on this broadcast from behind these enemy lines of USA Inc. The first story that I want to jump to, since we don't have any calls or questions, I want to go ahead and move on to this story about black feminist Bell Hooks saying she can no longer support Hillary Clinton. For those that don't know, Bell Hooks is a black woman, obviously, icon in the black feminist movement, author, scholar, and whatnot. And, you know, I was kind of surprised to hear that she had ever supported Hillary Clinton. So I'm going to go ahead and let you take a listen to Bell Hooks.
I've talked a lot in these past few days about having once been a very pro-Hillary Clinton supporter. But finding at this stage of life and the stage of her politics that I can no longer be a Hillary Clinton supporter in the name of feminism. There are certain things that I don't want to co-sign in the name of feminism that I think are militarist, imperialist, white supremacist, whether they are conducted by women or men. And I think that having to go through those changes and having to be compassionate towards yourself, because there are a lot of women that are feeling political turmoil right now because of our history of supporting feminists, supporting a woman, looking forward to the day when we can say, oh, we have a woman president. And that constant challenge about identity politics versus who are you and what do you stand for? I mean, that's why Baldwin says, it's not a question of whether you're gay or straight or black or white. What do you stand for? Who are you? How can you know that and operate from that position of power?
So that was Bell Hooks, and I was unable to find the – it looks like she was participating in some kind of panel or conference. I could not find – somebody asked me where the rest of it was. I have not been able to find it. Someone shared it on Facebook, and that's how I came across it. She made those comments about 3 days ago. And this goes into something I have been talking about. I even discussed it yesterday, for all of these black women to be supporting a white supremacist. And Bell Hooks basically just called Hillary Clinton a white supremacist. All right. She doesn't have to act like Donald Trump. She doesn't have to use the same language as David Duke and just be blatant with it. But if you pay attention to the words that she have said over the length of her political career, whether she was holding elective political office, whether she was the first lady pushing, helping her husband push policies and sell them to the public, it is an undeniable white supremacy. And whatnot. So, you know, it is just very troubling to me that so many black women have been supporting this woman, and they are her main base of support. They are voting for her in higher numbers than white males and white females in the Democratic Party. Black women have snuck up on us and become the largest voting bloc in the country. Starting in 2008, for whatever reason, they stayed home in 2010 along with most black people. Now, I don't want to just single them out. But then they turned out again in huge numbers in 2012 for Obama's reelection. And now they're turning out in record numbers again in this primary season. And they are voting overwhelmingly for Hillary Clinton, despite her past. And the only thing I can chalk that up to, where there are several things we could chalk that up to. Bell Hooks talked about identity politics. You know, it's no different than huge numbers of black people voting for Barack Obama simply because he's black, because they think that he will identify with me. He knows my pain and all of that, and not in a false sense, or you know, like Bill Clinton is the one that quote is attributed to, you know. So, you know, they thought that Barack Obama would be authentic, you know, in feeling the pain or empathizing with black people. And if you check the record, forget the words, forget the singing at the Harlem Theater. I forget the name of that place. Used to come on TV, historic place where entertainers have, you know, entertain black people in New York City and whatnot. Forget all of that. Forget the mimicking the black preacher when, you know, he said what he said down there in Charleston and whatnot. And see, we, you know, it's not nothing new, but, you know, it's really becoming a bigger problem when we have a white supremacist in Hillary Clinton being supported by black women. In such huge numbers. We can also chalk that up to a lack of information about Hillary Clinton's policies. All right, let's just be real. Most of us do not do our research. I'm talking to us who do vote. We don't do our research on these candidates, you know, and we shouldn't just be researching who's running to be the next CEO of USA Inc., but, you know, who is this person that wants to be the next sheriff that's going to be running the local jail where, you know, people might be abused, or like in Flint, Michigan, in the case of Flint, Michigan, forced to use poison water and whatnot. Who is going to be, you know, on the city council? You know, and a shout out to our abolitionist candidate in Baltimore for the Baltimore City Council, District Number 5. Christopher Irvin. Who are they? We don't do our research. I'm talking about the vast majority of us, and it's a problem. And it's not unique to us. I don't want to make it seem like I'm just picking on black people, because we've seen that, and black people have commented on how all of these poor white people in these so-called red states vote for a party that wants to continue to cut the social safety net. And when they know, like in the area that I live in, all these jobs have left the area, and you know you got that EBT card in your pocketbook or in your wallet, and you need that to survive, you know, and they will vote against their own interests. Well, we're seeing that now with black people in regards to Hillary Clinton, you know. And so that's just a problem. And like, you know, my mother was saying, and I might have mentioned it yesterday, and a lot of people have weighed in on Facebook when I relayed her comments, is that, you know, she said Hillary Clinton knows how to manipulate women on their emotions and whatnot. And I had reported, you know, early on when she first formed her campaign, the information came out that was a strategy. That was a deliberate strategy to reach out to these mothers of these murdered children and other people and wrangle them in to be her spokespersons, to be her attack dogs in the media, attacking everybody else and whatnot. And you know, when I hear these women talk about why they're supporting Hillary Clinton, I'm not hearing any kind of logical reasoning. I'm not hearing because, you know, she put forth this on her platform or that on her platform. I'm not hearing that. And, you know, I logged on to Twitter today on Black Talk Radio. It's at Black Talk Radio on Twitter. Let me go ahead and find this ad. First thing I saw, you know, was an ad from the Hillary Clinton campaign featuring these women. And I watched the ad. I listened to them to see if any of them will say anything concrete that's pointing to concrete legislation or proposals that she has made. And I just simply did not hear that. I'm just hearing a whole bunch of emotionalism and generalities. Let me see if I can find that, because I replied to campaign ad with my own video that I made about it. So let me see if I can pull this up. All right, here it is. Let me go ahead and enroll this.
Reveal.
Gwen Carr. Lucy McBath.
Maria.
My name is Sabrina Fulton, and my son was Trayvon Martin.
I'm the mother of Jordan Davis, a young man who was shot and killed for playing loud music in his car.
Trayvon was the person that comforted me whenever I was sick. He would make me soup.
Well, my son was a very gentle individual. Everybody used to call him the big teddy bear.
It was very funny going to the store with Sandy. She would rearrange your food. She would even put things back on the shelf because it wasn't good for you. She was unlawfully arrested as a result of a traffic stop. So she lost her life due to a traffic stop.
Dontre was my youngest. Dontre had a smile that would uplift your spirit. Dontre was killed by a Milwaukee police officer. There was no indictment.
The worst day of my life is when I had to bury my 17-year-old son.
Each of us has lived through our own tragedies, which are all different.
I just want people to understand that Sandy was so much more than that orange jumpsuit in the box.
I read the Michael Brown story, and at that point, it was like, no, not another one. At that point, I decided that I wanted to be their voice.
As a mother who lost her child, I was going to stand up and challenge the system and continue to tell my story.
I can't help Trayvon at this time, but there are other Trayvon Martins that I can help.
It's a story of a lot of young black males in this country.
Our young men and women are being murdered and nobody is being held accountable.
We're just not going to stand for this now.
This is my life's work to get justice.
Gun violence prevention.
Police reform.
We need to be accountable to making sure that my community is just as safe as any other person in this country.
This is what we need our officials to recognize.
The stakes are too high. The costs are too dear. And I am not and will not be afraid to keep fighting for common sense reform and, along with you, achieve those on behalf of all who have been lost.
She's been fighting for a long time with these issues.
Finally, someone here is really willing to listen and to really stimulate change.
I just feel like she's a person who is concerned about the needs of all people.
She has a heart to serve.
Now, again, that was the ad, the Twitter ad that Hillary Clinton put out, and I'm sure probably has run it in these states where you have a larger amount of black voters and whatnot. And all that's just an emotional ad, emotionalism, you know. And this woman, when you say that when Hillary Clinton says she will continue to fight for reforms and this, when has Hillary Clinton ever been fighting for these reforms? All right, you ain't heard her start talking about these issues until she started running for president, because she knows that it is a hot button issue for the black community. She has never, never, prior to now, ever talked about these issues. In fact, she was on the other side of the issue when she was calling these black kids and non-white kids super predators. Okay? In case y'all didn't hear it, here it is.
Red Lobster's lobster.
Okay, it wants to play an ad. Let's let that ad. But in case y'all hadn't heard her, all right, she called these kids super predators. The reform that she was pushing for, welfare reform in 1996, I believe that was. It, 1996. She was using the same language as racist white wingers back in the day, calling these people welfare queens who don't want to work. See, we want to attribute all that language, and rightly so, you know, to Republicans and right-wingers and the Reagan administration. He really advanced that welfare queen myth. But she used that same language. So you think, you know, most people, when they become adults, they become set in their core beliefs. There's no way in hell that this woman has changed her core beliefs at this stage in her life. The only reason she is repeating this stuff is because she needs black people to vote for her. Indeed, she wouldn't even have the delegate lead that she has right now in the Democratic primaries if not for black people, primarily black women, although black men are also voting for her in high numbers. But the thing is black men are not as big as a voting bloc as black women, because so many of us have been affected by, you know, the policies of disenfranchising black people through mass incarceration, hitting them with that felony status, and then guess what? You can't vote. It's illegal for you to vote. I'm not going to play that clip. I don't want to hear that anymore. But anyway, you know, these are the facts that's on the ground, and it just makes no sense. It makes no sense for black people in general to be voting against our own interests. It is just inexcusable for us not to research a candidate which has such a long history of criminality, racist cold words. And it's just no excuse for it. It's none. It's none. And she manipulated these women. And as you can see, all they're talking about is emotional type stuff. They not talking about any kind of policy proposals or anything like that. Hillary Clinton is lying to you. Hillary Clinton has always been pro-police in working to get the support of police unions throughout her entire career, or getting the support from the police unions for her husband. This is this woman. And then, you know, and now she's running for president. Oh, all of a sudden, you know, she's transformed herself and she no longer believes those things. Y'all can believe that crap if you want to. And another reason we know that black women is voting for her is, like Bell Hooks said, just cause she's a woman. Just cause she's a woman. Now, yesterday we talked about the overthrow of Honduras in 2009 by the Obama administration, with Hillary Clinton at the State Department leading the charge for that. Now, there was a woman, a feminist activist in Honduras, who was assassinated last week, Berta Caceres, I believe is how you pronounce her name, and she singled out Hillary Clinton for backing these Honduran coups. Now, let me say this, and I might have said it yesterday, but I'm going to say it again. I want y'all to think about this, okay? These black mothers who are, and I'm not attacking them, they emotional, what have you, whatever. But anyway, I wonder if they've taken into consideration all the children who have been killed, and those mothers whose children have been killed due to the foreign policies that Hillary Clinton still supports. Let me play this clip from Democracy Now.
Honduras. I want to go to Hillary Clinton and the 2009 coup in Honduras that ousted the democratically elected president, Manuel Zelaya. In her memoir, Hard Choices, Hillary Clinton wrote about the days following the coup. She wrote, quote, "In the subsequent days, I spoke with my counterparts around the hemisphere, including Secretary Patricia Espinosa of Mexico. We strategized on a plan to restore order in Honduras and ensure that free and fair elections would be held quickly and legitimately, which would render the question of Zelaya moot," unquote. Since the coup, Honduras has become one of the most dangerous places in the world. In 2014, the Honduran environmental activist Berta Cáceres spoke about Hillary Clinton's role in the 2009 coup. This is the woman who was assassinated last week in La Esperanza, Honduras. But she spoke about Hillary Clinton's role in the 2009 coup with the Argentine TV program Resumen Latino Americano.
"We're coming out of a coup that we can't put behind us. We can't reverse it. It just kept going. And after, there was the issue of the elections. The same Hillary Clinton, in her book Hard Choices, practically said what was going to happen in Honduras. This demonstrates the meddling of North Americans in our country. The return of the president, Mel Zelaya, became a secondary issue. There were going to be elections in Honduras. And he or she, Clinton, recognized that they didn't permit Mel Zelaya's return to the presidency. There were going to be elections. And the international community, officials, the government, the grand majority accepted this, even though we warned this was going to be very dangerous and that it would permit a barbarity, not only in Honduras, but in the rest of the continent. And we've been witnesses to this."
That was Honduran environmental activist Berta Cáceres speaking in 2014. She was murdered last week in her home in La Esperanza in Honduras. Last year, she won the Goldman Environmental Prize. She's a leading environmentalist in the world, Professor Grandin.
Yeah, and she criticizes Hillary Clinton's book, Hard Choices, where Clinton was holding up her actions in Honduras as an example of a clear-eyed pragmatism. I mean, that book is effectively a confession. Every other country in the world or in Latin America was demanding the restitution of democracy and the return of Manuel Zelaya. It was Clinton who basically relegated that to a secondary concern and insisted on elections, which had the effect of legitimizing and routinizing the coup regime and creating the nightmare scenario that exists today. I mean, and it's also in her emails. The real scandal about the emails isn't the question about process. You know, she wanted to create an off-the-books communication thing that couldn't be FOIA'd. The real scandal about those emails are the content of the emails. She talks the process by which she works to delegitimate Zelaya and legitimate the elections, which Cáceres in that interview talks about were taking place under extreme militarized conditions, fraudulent, fig leaf of democracy, are all in the emails.
And particularly, what does she say in them?
Well, she talks about trying to work towards a movement towards legitimating, getting other countries, pressuring other countries to accept the results of the election and give up the demand that Zelaya be returned and basically stop calling
Let's
it a
coup. Let's go to March 2010. This is Secretary of State Hillary Clinton traveling to meet with the Honduran President Porfirio Pepe Lobo, whose election was boycotted by opponents of the coup that overthrew Zelaya. She urged Latin American countries to normalize ties with the coup government.
"We think that Honduras has taken important and necessary steps that deserve the recognition and the normalization of relations. I have just sent a letter to the Congress of the United States notifying them that we will be restoring aid to Honduras. Other countries in the region say that they want to wait a while. I don't know what they're waiting for, but that's their right to wait."
That was Secretary of State Hillary Clinton endorsing the coup. What is the trajectory of what happened then to the horror of this past week, the assassination of Berta Cáceres?
Well, that's just one horror. I mean, hundreds of peasant activists and indigenous activists have been killed. Scores of gay rights activists have been killed. I mean, it's just a nightmare in Honduras. I mean, there's ways in which the coup regime basically threw up Honduras to transnational pillage. And Berta Cáceres in that interview says what was installed after the coup was something like a permanent counterinsurgency on behalf of transnational capital. And that wouldn't have been possible if it were not for Hillary Clinton's normalization of that election.
Greg Grandin, we're going to have to leave it there. Greg Grandin, professor of Latin American history at New York University's most recent book titled Kissinger's Shadow, The Long Reach of America's Most Controversial Statesman. This is Democracy.
Okay. Also, in those emails that he talked about, and yes, it is a crime. She did commit a crime with that private server in her house in New York and trying to circumvent transparency and whatnot. But he is right in the respect of what's contained in those emails that have been released. And as I have reported on this program, the coup that the United States ran against Libya, you know, and in the email between her and Sarkozy, or I think she was talking to this other guy about Sarkozy and whatnot, and about, you know, the issue being Gaddafi going to create that African Union currency backed by the gold dinar, which would become the top currency in the world when you consider all of the mineral wealth that is in Africa. All right. And so again, you know, I shared a video on Black Talk Radio Network's Facebook page from Afro Synergy Radio, Mr. T. West, and he posted a video about Tawerga, which was a predominantly black town in Libya, 30,000 people that has been wiped out. That was wiped out by those racist Arab militias. And Hillary Clinton also in the emails was told about these war crimes. But did you hear Hillary Clinton come on and say we need to put a stop to this and it's not right to be targeting these black people? They have a right to be there. They're Libyans too. And try to, you know, address the racism, Arab supremacy that was going on. No, hell no. So again, you know, this is, you know, a lot of this support in the black community for Hillary Clinton, I look at is willful ignorance, a lack of real information, and just, you know, identity politics. You know, Asada Shakur, I was reading a letter Asada Shakur wrote about her experience in prison, and she was talking about also about how black feminists can't get with white feminists that are racist and whatnot. That no matter how much that white feminist is being oppressed by the white male, her husband or father or whoever, their oppression is not nowhere near the oppression that is faced by black people. And that I think she called her Miss Ann or something, saying Miss Ann's a racist. So how in the hell can black feminists have a partnership with racist white feminists? And I think that would apply to Hillary Clinton. We do have a phone call, area code 973. Thank you for calling in. Go ahead with your question or comment.
Good afternoon, Mr. Reed. How are you?
I'm not going to complain too hard to you, but I'm just surviving.
That's good. I'm calling in, commenting on Hillary Clinton. I agree with you, first of all, that there's a lack of information out there about her. Again, I guess back in 2008, are we looking at eight, 16, I was going to support Hillary Clinton because she was a woman, quote unquote, not knowing all that I've learned thus far from the Black Talk Radio news. Again, we need more platforms so people can be educated about her. I think there's a lack of knowledge about what she's done. Also, I do agree with you with respect to Sabrina Fulton. Where was she? I mean, did she come? I'm wondering to myself, you keep talking about butter biscuits. I'm thinking they got some butter biscuits. They had to be because, I mean, where was Hillary Clinton when Trayvon Martin, they were all out there. She was nowhere to be found. The woman, I've never heard the woman in history talk about police brutality or things of that nature. I mean, just in retrospect, just thinking about, you know, her, she was here in New York. She was some senator in New York. What she did, I don't know, Mr. Reed. But I think somehow, some way, somebody's getting some serious butter biscuits. Because have you had the opportunity, side to sidebar, to invite Ms. Fulton and any of the other women who have been, parents who have lost their children, their sons or daughters to police brutality? Because I would like to know, Ms. Fulton was invited to speak at our organization, and she cannot speak. She didn't come. Something happened. I don't know what happened with some political thing or whatever. But she's not able to speak about the situation with her son. Somehow she has a gag or that she can't talk about it. But
might
does,
be part of that
know,
settlement
sort of
she got.
Yeah. And have you had the opportunity to invite her or any of those
yes.
people who Clinton had up there? I mean, I just it makes me so sick to my stomach, sir, because where was she ever? Ever, or even that matter for Bernie Sanders in terms of when they had that march. I remember Sharpton was calling for the march because here they didn't even arrest this guy who killed him, and they just took his word, and then there was a whole big thing. Then they had the big old march, and then they got him arrested. But none of these political figures were nowhere to be found. And I say again to myself, I said a lot of women are voting for Hillary because she's a woman not knowing. So again, I just stress to you again and again that if we just get our more platforms out there about Hillary, I've been trying to tell everybody anytime I hear any clips from you, I write them down and send them out to people, letting them hear them. And trust me, they're changing their minds. I've probably done changed like 5 people's mind in the last week or so. So that's a start. You know, just letting them know who you guys are and tune in to what's going on. Because again, like I said, I'm an educated Black woman. I did not know about, you know, her and this whole thing about Super Predator and her about other things that she has done. So, you know, again, lack of knowledge, you don't know, and therefore, you know, again, we need to have our own platforms. I don't mean to sound redundant, but it's so essential. You know, you always repeat about Malcolm X said about how we have to have our own media to tell our own story. So that's where, and I, like I said, in the South Carolina, there's like a machine. I know you probably touched upon the article, Mr. Reed, that was in the New York Times about the Black women saying that they felt so bad that, you know, they didn't vote for Hillary Clinton. Not that they felt bad, but they had turned their attention to Mr. Barack Obama because he was Black. So they feel in debt now. This is what the women wow. of the South were saying in the article, that they need to vote for Hillary Clinton. I'm saying, how do you be in debt to someone? She's not your cousin or so. Well, where would this indebtedness come from?
Right.
So I'm just like, I just hope, and I keep saying, I'm going to pass the word as much as I can, that I hope that you can resend those letters, Mr. Reed, to those people we talked about maybe a week ago, asking them to hopefully get more platforms for Black voices such as this to get the truth out. I really appreciate you letting me speak, and thank you for your time, sir.
Thank you. Thank you. Just to answer the question.
Q&A queue is cleared.
Just to answer the question, no, I have not reached out to them recently, but around the times of their children's murders, you know, we covered Trayvon Martin case a lot. I made a whole bunch of YouTube videos during that time, and yes, I reached out to both the father and the mother and did not hear anything back. I reached out to Jordan Davis' mother, well as his father as well, didn't hear anything back. So I reached out to them at the time of their tragedies. I allowed some time to pass, you know, for them to mourn and whatnot. But when, you know, it drug on, I did invite them, but I never heard back from them. I have not even considered inviting them on the program to ask them to explain their support for Hillary Clinton or whatnot, because I don't see anything constructive that would come out of that. All right. I just, you know, I don't think that I would be able to change their minds, because the deed has already been done, and they probably would be concerned about looking foolish and whatnot if they all of a sudden reverse their position or whatnot. So because I did not want to risk the chance of some conflict with those mothers and whatnot, I just said, you know, I'm just not going to do it. I'm just going to just, you know, do what I do and report what I know and what I have found about Hillary Clinton. So that's why I have not reached out to them or anyone on this that was supporting, that is supporting Hillary Clinton. Just want to minimize conflict with these women, because I view these women as victims. Victims, you know, again. I hope I'm not sounding like a sexist or anything like that, but we know I it's of my opinion that women are a little bit more emotional than males are, you know, and I think that's a good thing. You know, it can be a good thing, but it can also turn into a bad thing as well. And so I view them as victims. I know Hillary Clinton probably got some of them black women surrogates and sent them first to soften these women up, and then she came herself and whatnot, and they're just being, I view them as victims. They're being manipulated. I'm not making an excuse for them, but because I feel like these women are old enough and should be educated enough, even though I don't know if they're college graduates or anything like that. Not that you need a piece of paper to be an intelligent person or whatnot, that you need to attend college or graduate college to be intelligent or anything like that. But you would think, you know, before you jump into presidential politics and throw your endorsement behind somebody, that you would make sure you vet them. And so, I mean, if I had opportunity to ask them questions, again, I don't want to talk to these women because I want to minimize conflict between them, between myself and them. But if I was a journalist out there and I had an opportunity, let's say I went to some event and she was speaking there, I would ask them, you know, I would ask them, well, how much do you really know about Hillary Clinton? What do you know about her super predator comments? What do you know about the welfare queen comments and whatnot during the 1990s, you know, when Trayvon Martin was just 1 year old in the crib and, you know, she was helping races in this country push that or advance this racist theory about super predators of not just black kids, but Latino kids as well, non-white people. I would ask them, you know. And then, you know, depending upon the answer, I would come up, I'm sure, with some follow-up questions to that and whatnot. I would ask them, well, what do you know about her foreign policy? You know, how do you feel about all those black people being murdered in Libya, including black children and whatnot? What about these people in Honduras, this coup she organized and overthrowing, I mean, not organized, but supported? You know, Bill Gates, the United States engineered that coup and whatnot. And so I would ask them these questions, and I just don't think that I would get a straight answer to begin with, you know, because we're pretty far in. They've already, you know, put their name to endorsing this monster, I would call her, this monster. And so I just don't think anything constructive would come out of that. So that's my reasoning. Yeah. So let me move on to the next story. Ben Carson endorsing Donald Trump. As I said at the beginning of my program, my mom's is a very spiritual person, Christian, you know, practicing Christian and whatnot. And she was kind of a fan, along with some of her other friends, of Ben Carson. They went to hear him speak, and I'm not sure if it was Charlotte, North Carolina, somewhere here in North Carolina, they went to hear him speak and whatnot, and they believed that he was a Christian. And my mom had even talked about voting for him in the Republican primary. She's registered as an independent here in North Carolina. And just last week, I was talking to her again, and she was like, I'm thinking about, you know, voting for Ben Carson in the Republican primaries and whatnot. And I was like, Mom, I told you that this guy, you know, minimizes racism if he doesn't deny it exists, you know, if he's not denying that it exists at all. He tells these racist white people at the CPAC, you know, the conservative action, what is it, the Conservative Political Action Committee, they just recently had their annual event. He goes to those and he deals in racist talking points. I'm telling you, Mom, you know, he is not the same kind of Christian as you are, all right? You know, and I question his intelligence. And, you know, yeah, sure, he has book knowledge. We cannot deny, you know, the intelligence or the talent that this man has in the area of medicine. Okay, do not want to diminish his accomplishment in that area whatsoever. But that just goes to show you, again, that book knowledge does not always translate to common sense, because sometimes I've heard this man say some stuff come out of his mouth that I'm like, I'm thinking, man, you sound like, you know, Forrest Gump or something, you know, that you're just so simplistic and you sound simple minded, you know. And I've known people like that, very, very intelligent when it comes to book smarts, but when it comes to what we call common sense, you know, they didn't get a hefty portion of common sense and whatnot. And so when she heard that Donald Trump was being endorsed by Ben Carson, she said, now I'm looking at him real differently, because how can you support this man who is engaging in racism, who is promoting this mob violence against black people, you know, in the crowds that are going there protesting. She was talking about, you know, look at how they pushing on that woman. You know, we won't talk about violence against women and whatnot. Look at how they was treating that young black woman. How can you endorse someone like that? You know, this is my mom speaking about Ben Carson. And so I told her last night, I said, you know what? I bet you he's angling to get a cabinet position. He believes that Trump has an insurmountable lead, which, you know, I would tend to agree with that, unless there's some kind of crooked shenanigans with the Republican primaries. Donald Trump will be the nominee. OK, and I'm thinking that that's what Ben Carson sees that. And so he's going to jump on what he feels like is going to be the winning, you know, candidate for the Republican nominee, and so that he can get some butter biscuits. And so my mom was saying, well, I don't know about all that. Well, lo and behold, in the Washington Post, here is Ben Carson talking about, you know, getting some butter biscuits and whatnot. Let me just, this article, again, is linked up to the Washington Post. And I mean, even the way Trump was launching personal attacks about Carson and whatnot, and then Carson sitting up there and saying, oh, that's just politics and whatnot. Really, dude? Really? You just showing me you have no self-respect whatsoever. Let me see. I'm going to jump to the middle of the article. Let me see. Trump and Carson weren't always so chummy. The mogul once said the retired surgeon has a pathological disease with no cure, similar to being a child molester. Trump, who is Presbyterian, also raised doubts about Carson's Seventh-day Adventist faith. Carson, who has a winter home in nearby West Palm Beach, visited Trump at Mar-a-Lago on Thursday morning for breakfast over a spread of pastries, fruit, and coffee, and without aides present. The two men spoke for over an hour. Armstrong Williams, another proxy racist, Carson's longtime confidant and business manager, assisted in arranging the meeting. In an interview with the Washington Post, Carson described Trump's demeanor during their get-together as very humble, very graceful, and very open to suggestions. I think this whole process is starting to sink in. The fact that he could be president of the United States, Carson said. Trump's past attacks on Carson never came up. They didn't bother me that much at the time. I fully expected it, Carson said when asked about Trump's barrage last year over biographical stories from Carson's youth. When that happened, he was fighting to catch up. And sometimes when people are frightened, they say foolish things, okay? Yeah, like these white people that's afraid that, you know, they will no longer be the predominant or dominant population with them projected to become a minority in 2050 and whatnot. And, you know, their whole thing about taking our country back, all of that's fear-based, and he feeds into that fear. That fear. So, I mean, this dude Carson, man, he sounds like he has no self-respect whatsoever. Now, he said moving forward, he added, he would like to be part of Trump's kitchen cabinet on policy while also keeping busy with his own political activities and appearance. My real ideal now is to get involved in crafting policy that will save this country. Education, healthcare reform, those are my two major issues. Again, this is the dude that compared the Affordable Care Act to slavery. Yeah, he did that. He did that. And so he is. He's angling for a position in Trump's cabinet. Perhaps he wants to be the next U.S. Surgeon General. You know, he wants to be the second black U.S. Surgeon General. Remember Jocelyn Elders? Yeah, she was the first one. She was appointed by Bill Clinton before they forced her out because of policy differences, where Jocelyn Elders back in the 90s was saying that if we want to reduce crime, maybe we need to legalize drugs instead of locking all these people up and stuff like that. And, you know, treating this as a health issue instead of a criminal issue. And, you know, then not long after that she made those comments, next thing you know, her son is being arrested for allegedly selling drugs, which she said she believes he was framed and set up to embarrass her because she just called for the legalization of drugs to reduce crime. Then she had to go. She had to go, and perhaps behind the scenes she was not down with that mass incarceration legislation that the Clintons, both Hillary and Bill, were pushing. So I think that's possibly what he's angling for, a cabinet position. Because, hell, I don't know what kitchen cabinet means. I don't know what that means, you know. So I'm assume he's talking about getting a cabinet position in a Trump administration. So I wanted to share that. The last story I want to share, I keep forgetting this one. I don't know this woman's first name. Omarosa. Let me see if I can find her first name right quick. But she was on Chris Matthews. I don't like that dude. Okay, that's her first name. Omarosa Manigault. She was on Trump's reality show. I think she was married to that black actor, Clark Duncan or something of that effect, who played in The Green Mile and some other movies as well, who recently died. That was her boyfriend and whatnot. But, yeah, Omarosa was on, what was that show? Chris Matthews, I believe, is the guy's name. You know, suspected racist and whatnot. Don't like him at all, but she was on his program, and he was asking her about her support for Trump when Trump's out here calling for all this violence, and what do you make of this, and what have you. So let's go ahead and give that a listen.
One could argue by what they heard at the event, and they punched the guy. What do you make of that?
You know, I think that it's very...
You can't control 5,000 or 10,000 people.
You can't control them, but it's very interesting that no one's covering...
Now, let me stop it there, because, see, I watch mainstream media from time to time. Not a whole lot. I do pay particular more attention to it during the political seasons. But Chris Matthews, I have noticed his style of hosting that program, and he definitely put those words in her mouth. He's not being objective. He's actually providing cover for Donald Trump while pretending like, you know, he's questioning all of this. So you're like, oh, you can't control 5,000 people. And then what did she say? Repeat it just like a parrot. I tell you, man, them Jedi mind tricks, boy.
The protesters at Hillary's rallies or at Kasich rallies,
well,
or Cruz rallies.
Have any of them been slugged?
Absolutely. Have you seen the coverage? Black Lives Matter is everywhere. And I believe that this gentleman says he's a part of Black Lives Matter. These Black Lives Matter protesters are prepared for any kind of environment that they go into.
You've
got to
take
make
and
their
show
point.
Us. And then just point us to it. I'd love to find if somebody getting slugged, a sucker punch in the
face.
Well,
I think that there was some very hostile moments at the AU Center in Atlanta.
Yeah.
When Hillary Clinton was there speaking, there was a large group of Black Lives Matter protesters who were jostled around, pushed around by security, who
but
were
did
handled.
Any of the, did any of the
and
Hillary
I don't think that was covered. But Donald,
any of the Hillary people
no, but
do
you
that
know what,
kind
Chris?
Of thing?
Donald can't be responsible for
well,
every single person.
That. Let's get
that
back
comes
to
his rally. But we also have to cover the fact that this is not the only candidate
okay,
that has protesters
okay.
at their rally.
It's not about
out
protesters.
Fairness.
It's what's being done to protesters.
What do you mean what's being done to protesters? This is a country that you have the right to assemble. You have the right to free speech. You also have the, right,
the right
to go
to
into.
Slug a guy
you have
for
a right
protesting?
To go into. Listen, you have a right to go into a closed private event, and you get what's coming to you. I do not
what's
condone violence, but if you go into an environment where you're interrupting 13, 14 times, do you expect a hug or kumbaya? Come on,
well, what
Chris.
Do you think is coming
these,
to these people?
Listen, these protesters know exactly what they're getting at this point. They've seen how protesters are not given a pass and allowed to take over these events. If you go to a Donald Trump rally, here's
a
newsflash.
You judge this.
Let's
say the tapes are great. Let's go to the tapes.
We're not allowed to punch back anymore. I love the old days. You know what they used to do to guys like that when they were in a place like this? They'd be carried out on a stretcher, folks. I'd like to punch him in the face, I'll tell you.
What do you make of that?
He's a New Yorker. What do you want him
you
to
see
say?
The guy behind him on the left?
Do you think he's from Kansas
right?
or something?
Did you see the guy's reaction?
He's from New York.
Did you see the guy's
Brooklyn
reaction?
Boy. He's not going to be pushed around, Chris.
Do you think it's all right to incite that kind of behavior?
Not at all. He's not
so explain where you are on this.
Here's
I can't figure out where you are. You
First
say
all,
you can't control the crowd.
You can't. It's impossible.
Okay, let me
There's
ask 30, you this.
People
You're
in that
close
room.
To the guy. Why doesn't he go?
All right. Let me stop it there. Again, you know, they get what's coming to them and whatnot. You know, again, man, proxy racism is the greatest tool that the white supremacist has ever come up with to use as a weapon against black people. And again, as I stated at the beginning of the program, unfortunately, you know, non-white people, including black people, have a history of helping the United States government, helping corporations, helping politicians, just helping white supremacists, racist white people, helping them so that they can be more comfortable on the plantation or in exchange for, you know, a cushy job as, you know, the Surgeon General and whatnot. This is just, you know, shameful. This is just really, really shameful that she would. Now, she's correct. Black Lives Matter have been protesting at all of these events and whatnot. But what you know, when Black Lives Matter, those women snatched the mic from Bernie Sanders, what did he do? Did he call security on them? Did he push them off the stage? Did he get in a fight with them and try to snatch the mic back? Or did he let them have their say? And then what happened afterwards? Well, he hired some of them. All right. He hired some of them to craft a racial justice policy. Yes, they've been going to Hillary Clinton events and whatnot as well. I remember at a church, Black Lives Matter, where she was speaking at a church, and Black Lives Matter people were in there chanting and being disruptive, you know, exercising their First Amendment speech, Omarosa, and whatnot. And then you had all the other black people with some black politicians. I think John Lewis was there as well. And they started shouting them down. But they did not get up and beat them up and punch them in the face or anything like that. And Hillary Clinton didn't say, you know, they should be, you know, I remember the good old days when niggas would get lynched for stepping out of their place or interrupting the white person when they're speaking. You know, she has been kind of disrespectful on one-on-one conversations with some of these activists. But that, Omarosa's lying. This stuff has not occurred at any of the Sanders rallies. I haven't heard about them occurring at the Kasich rallies, who's a Republican, John Kasich. I haven't heard about it happening at any rally except for Trump rallies. So how much is you getting paid, Omarosa? How much is your soul? How much did your soul cost, you know, to just get up there and blatantly lie about such things? Now, y'all know if people was getting jumped on at Hillary Clinton's rally and I heard about it, I definitely would make sure you know about it. But I'm definitely sure it would be reported on. I'm definitely sure we would have seen video of this happening by now, by people at these events recording this. And look, a political rally is not a private event. If you're having it at a public venue and it's open to the public, Omarosa, then it's a public event. Now, if it's a private event, Hillary Clinton did have a private event recently in South Carolina where you had to pay $500 to get in the door. That was a private event. Wasn't held at a public venue or nothing like that. It looked like somebody's house. I don't know. I could be wrong. It could have been a place that they had rented or whatnot. But it was closed door. These Trump rallies are not closed door. They're not charging people to get in. They are open to the public. These are not private events. And You know, I was talking to my mom about it, and she was saying somebody needs to make a petition calling on the attorney generals at these different states where these assaults have occurred, where you have evidence of Donald Trump inciting violence, and call for these attorney generals to do their damn jobs and indict Donald Trump for inciting violence. Now, I told my mom, I said, you know what? You're right. Because in some of those instances, he's being very specific in his incitement of violence. But I don't expect these white supremacists to arrest him or anything like that. But just to point out to people the hypocrisy of the criminal justice system where suspected racist white supremacists like Donald Trump get a pass on breaking laws. This man, this is just more evidence that we live in a system with institutional racism. As I was doing case research, at which I wrote an article when I called out Tim Wise for saying that the Constitution allows people to run up to you in the street and call you a nigger, and you can't hit them or you can't do nothing and whatnot. And I pulled up the case of Komplinski versus New Jersey, the state of New Jersey. It was a Supreme Court case in the 1940s where it was called fighting words. You just can't run up in people's face and hurl insults and obscene language and whatnot and expect them to just take it. You know, those are fighting words, and you'll get punched in the damn mouth. And so First Amendment speech does not recognize that. That's according to the Supreme Court decision. Now, I'm still doing research on it, but I came across another case where in 1969, and I was not surprised by this, the Supreme Court, where this Klan member of the Klan in the 1969, who was advocating for violence against black people, he was convicted on some state law, and he appealed his conviction all the way up to the Supreme Court. Do you know they reversed his conviction? They reversed his conviction and said he had a First Amendment right to do that, to call for direct violence against black people. Now, what the hell do you think will happen, you know, to black people if they say, you know, let's go out here and find out where these Klan, who these Klan members are, and where they live and whatnot, and let's assassinate them. Let's assassinate them the same way that civil rights workers and black power workers, activists, was assassinated during the siege. Y'all know they'll come and arrest me. Y'all know that. They will come and arrest me. Because First Amendment was never intended to protect the black person. All right? So, you know, it's just shameful, man. It's shameful. Just shameful. Anyway, that's my program. I will be back on air. Won't be back on air till Monday. Political Prisoner Radio is still in a hiatus right now, but we will be bringing it back. It has not been canceled, but I won't be back on air till Monday. And by the way, for the donors to the Black Talk Media Project, I will be finished with the reports this weekend, and I will send the reports out to all our donors to our North Carolina-based nonprofit Black Talk Media Project, which manages Black Talk Radio Network and assists other independent black media producers in helping them learn the technology as well as providing them with low-cost radio streams. So, thank you all for tuning in, and be safe this weekend, because a lot of things tend to happen over the weekend because a lot of people partake of alcohol and whatnot. And, you know, it's a battlefield out there. You can become a casualty in the blink of an eye if you do not develop battlefield awareness, just being aware of your surroundings and whatnot, and anticipating danger and whatnot. You know, we got to develop our skills, man, so that we don't become easy victims and targets and whatnot. That's why you won't see me go to a Trump rally to protest nothing. Because Scotty know that the first time a cracker spit on him or hits him, that, you know, I might end up getting killed because I'm not going to passively take that, you know. We're going to be brawling up in that joint. So that's why I don't put myself in such a position, you know, to be killed or arrested, because, you know, they'll blame it on me and say I started it. So anyway, just develop battlefield awareness. Don't become an easy casualty. Be careful this weekend. No drinking and driving. No smoking weed and driving, you know, for you to get pulled over and then, you know, you're going to jail over that. Those are things that are preventable, okay? So let's not be foolish out there. Peace and blessings. Again, peace and blessings to all. Y'all be safe out there. Stay tuned for Tando Radio Show.
We have to begin to move to control our community. Everything that's in your community that you don't control is a weapon against you. Public education as it exists today is a weapon against black people. TV and news media, especially the WPP, white power press, white people's paper, and white people's power are enemies against black people. What the white press does is that it makes black people an enemy of black people.